Ladies and gentlemen, join us now for a Radio Lillooet special presentation of Jacob Abbott's Peter the Great in 7 parts.
Chapter 6 of Peter the Great. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Peter the Great by Jacob Abbott. Chapter 6. The Emperor's Tour, 1697. At the time when the Emperor issued his orders to so many of the sons of the nobility, requiring them to go and reside for a time in the cities of Western Europe, he formed the design of going himself to make a tour in that part of the world, for the purposes of visiting the courts and capitals, and seeing with his own eyes what arts and improvements were to be found there, which might be advantageously introduced to his own dominions. In the spring of the year 1697, he thought that the time had come for carrying this idea into effect. The plan which he formed was not to travel openly in his own name, for he knew that in this case a great portion of his time and attention, in the different courts and capitals, would be wasted in the grand parades, processions, and ceremonies with which the different sovereigns would doubtless endeavour to honour his visit. He therefore determined to travel incognito, in the character of a private person, in the train of an embassy. An embassy could proceed more quietly from place to place than a monarch travelling in his own name, and then, besides, if the emperor occupied only a subordinate place in the train of the embassy, he could slip away from it to pursue his own inquiries in a private manner whenever he pleased, leaving the ambassadors themselves and those of their train who enjoyed such scenes to go through all the public receptions and other pompous formalities which would have been so tiresome to him. General Lefort, who had by this time been raised to a very high position under Peter's government, was placed at the head of this embassy. 2 other great officers of state were associated with him. Then came secretaries, interpreters, and subordinates of all kinds, in great numbers, among whom Peter was himself enrolled under a fictitious name. Peter took with him several young men of about his own age. 2 or 3 of these were particular friends of his, whom he wished to have accompany him for the sake of their companionship on the journey. There were some others whom he selected on account of the talent which they had evinced for mechanical and mathematical studies. These young men he intended to have instructed in the art of shipbuilding in some of the countries which the embassy were to visit. Besides these arrangements, in respect to the embassy, provision was, of course, to be made by the emperor for the government of the country during his absence. He left the administration in the hands of 3 great nobles, the first of whom was one of his uncles, his mother's brother. The name of this prince was Naraskin. The other 2 nobles were associated with Naraskin in the regency. These commissioners were to have the whole charge of the government of the country during the Tsar's absence. Peter's little son, whose name was Alexis, and who was now about 7 years old, was also committed to their keeping. Not having entire confidence in the fidelity of the old guards, Peter did not trust the defense of Moscow to them, but he garrisoned the fortifications in and around the capital with a force of about 12,000 men that he had gradually brought together for that purpose. A great many of these troops, both officers and men, were foreigners. Peter placed greater reliance on them on that account, supposing that they would be less likely to sympathize with and join the people of the city in case of any popular discontent or disturbances. The guards were sent off into the interior and towards the frontiers, where they could do no great mischief, even if disposed. At length, when everything was ready, the embassy set out from Moscow. The departure of the expedition from the gates of the city made quite an imposing scene, so numerous was the party which composed the ambassador's train. There were in all about 300 men. The principal persons of the embassy were, of course, splendidly mounted and equipped, and they were followed by a line of wagons conveying supplies of clothing, stores, presents for foreign courts, and other baggage. This baggage train was, of course, attended by a suitable escort. Vast multitudes of people assembled along the streets and at the gates of the city to see the grand procession commence its march. The first place of importance at which the embassy stopped was the city of Riga, on the shores of the Gulf of Riga, in the eastern part of the Baltic Sea. Riga and the province in which it was situated, though now a part of the Russian Empire, then belonged to Sweden. It was the principal port on the Baltic in those days, and Peter felt a great interest in viewing it, as there was then no naval outlet in that direction from his dominions. The governor of Riga was very polite to the embassy, and gave them a very honorable reception in the city, but he refused to allow the ambassadors to examine the fortifications. It had been arranged beforehand between the ambassadors and Peter that two of them were to ask permission to see the fortifications, and that Peter himself was to go around with them as their attendant when they made their visit, in order that he might make his own observations in respect to the strength of the work and the mode of their construction. Peter was accordingly very much disappointed and vexed at the refusal of the governor to allow the fortifications to be viewed, and he secretly resolved that he would seize the first opportunity after his return to open a quarrel with the King of Sweden and take this city away from him. Leaving Riga, the embassy moved on towards the southward and westward, until, at length, they entered the dominions of the King of Prussia. They came soon to the city of Königsberg, which was at that time the capital. The reception of the embassy at this city was attended with great pomp and display. The whole party halted at a small village at the distance of about a mile from the gates, in order to give time for completing the arrangements, and to await the arrival of a special messenger and an escort from the king to conduct them within the walls. At length, when all was ready, the procession formed about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. First came a troop of horses that belonged to the king. They were splendidly caparisoned, but were not mounted. They were led by grooms. Then came an escort of troops of the royal guards. They were dressed in splendid red uniform, and were preceded by kettledrums. Then a company of the Prussian nobility in beautifully decorated coaches, each drawn by 6 horses. Next came the state carriages of the king. The king himself was not in either of them, it being etiquette for the king to remain in his palace and receive the embassy at a public audience there after their arrival. The royal carriages were sent out, however, as a special though indirect token of respect to the Tsar, who was known to be in the train. Then came a procession of pages, consisting of those of the king and those of the ambassadors, marching together. These pages were all beautiful boys, elegantly dressed in characteristic liveries of red laced with gold. They marched 3 together, 2 of the king's pages in each rank, with 1 of the ambassadors between them. The spectators were very much interested in these boys, and the boys were likewise doubtless much interested in each other, but they could not hold any conversation with each other, for probably those of each set could speak only their own language. Next, after the pages, came the embassy itself. First, there was a line of 36 carriages, containing the principal officers and attendants of the 3 ambassadors. In one of these carriages, riding quietly, with the rest as a subordinate in the train, was Peter. There was doubtless some vague intimation circulating among the crowd that the Emperor of Russia was somewhere in the procession, concealed in his disguise. But there were no means of identifying him, and, of course, whatever curiosity the people felt on the subject remained ungratified. Next, after these carriages, came the military escort which the ambassadors had brought with them. The escort was headed by the ambassador's band of music, consisting of trumpets, kettledrums, and other martial instruments. Then came a body of foot guards. Their uniform was green, and they were armed with silver battle-axes. Then came a troop of horsemen, which completed the escort. Immediately after the escort, there followed the grand state carriage of the embassy, with the 3 ambassadors in it. The procession was closed by a long train of elegant carriages, conveying various personages of wealth and distinction, who had come from the city to join in doing honor to the strangers. As the procession entered the city, they found the streets through which they were to pass densely lined on each side by the citizens who had assembled to witness the spectacle. Through this vast concourse the ambassadors and their suite advanced, and were finally conducted to a splendid palace which had been prepared for them in the heart of the city. The garrison of the city was drawn up at the gates of the palace to receive them as they arrived. When the carriage reached the gate and the ambassadors began to alight, a grand salute was fired from the guns of the fortress. The ambassadors were immediately conducted to their several apartments in the palace by the officers who had led the procession, and then left to repose. When the officers were about to withdraw, the ambassadors accompanied them to the head of the stairs and took leave of them there. The doors of the palace and the halls and entrances leading to the apartments of the ambassadors were guarded by 24 soldiers, who were stationed there as sentinels to protect the precincts from all intrusion. 4 days after this there was another display, when the ambassadors were admitted to their first public audience with the king. There was again a grand procession through the streets, with great crowds assembled to witness it, and bands of music, and splendid uniforms, and gorgeous equipages, all more magnificent, if possible, than before. The ambassadors were conducted in this way to the royal palace. They entered the hall, dressed in cloth of gold and silver, richly embroidered, and adorned with precious stones of great value. Here they found the king seated on a throne, and attended by all the principal nobles of his court. The ambassadors advanced to pay their reverence to His Majesty, bearing in their hands, in a richly ornamented box, a letter from the Tsar, with which they had been entrusted for him. There were a number of attendants also, who were loaded with rich and valuable presents which the ambassadors had brought to offer to the king. The presents consisted of the most costly furs, tissues of gold and silver, precious stones, and the like, all productions of Russia, and of very great value. The king received the ambassadors in a very honorable manner, and made them an address of welcome in reply to the brief addresses of salutation and compliment which they first delivered to him. He received the letter from their hands and read it. The presents were deposited on tables which had been set up for the purpose. The letter stated that the Tsar had sent the embassy to assure him of his desire to improve the affection and good correspondence which had always existed, as well between His Royal Highness and himself, as between their illustrious ancestors. It said also that, the same embassy being from thence to proceed to the court of Vienna, the Tsar requested the king to help them on their journey, and finally it expressed the thanks of the Tsar for the engineers and bombardiers which the king had sent him during the past year, and who had been so useful to him in the siege of Azov. The king, having read the letter, made a verbal reply to the ambassadors, asking them to thank the Tsar in his name for the friendly sentiments which his letter expressed, and for the splendid embassy which he had sent to him. All this time the Tsar himself, the author of the letter, was standing by, a quiet spectator of the scene, undistinguishable from the other secretaries and attendants that formed the ambassador's train. After the ceremony of audience was completed, the ambassadors withdrew. They were reconducted to their lodgings with the same ceremonies as were observed in their coming out, and then spent the evening at a grand banquet provided for them by the elector. All the principal nobility of Prussia were present at this banquet, and after it was concluded, the town was illuminated with a great display of fireworks, which continued until midnight. The sending of a grand embassage like this from one royal or imperial potentate to another was a very common occurrence in those times. The pomp and parade with which they were accompanied were intended equally for the purpose of illustrating the magnificence of the government that sent them, and of offering a splendid token of respect to the one to which they were sent. Of course, the expense was enormous, both to the sovereign who sent and to the one who received the compliment. But such sovereigns as those were very willing to expend money in parades which exhibited before the world the evidences of their own grandeur and power, especially as the mass of the people, from whose toils the means of defraying the cost was ultimately to come, were so completely held in subjection by military power that they could not even complain, far less could they take any effectual measures for calling their oppressors to account. In governments that are organized at the present day, either by the establishment of new constitutions or by the remodeling and reforming of old ones, all this is changed. The people understand now that all the money which is expended by their governments is ultimately paid by themselves, and they are gradually devising means by which they can themselves exercise a greater and greater control over these expenditures. They retain a far greater portion of the avails of their labor in their own hands, and expend it in adorning and making comfortable their own habitations, and cultivating the minds of their children, while they require the government officials to live and travel and transact their business in a more quiet and unpretending way than was customary of yore. Thus, in traveling over most parts of the United States, you will find people who cultivate the land living in comfortable, well-furnished houses, with separate rooms appropriately arranged for the different uses of the family. There is a carpet on the parlor floor, and there are books in the bookcase, and good supplies of comfortable clothing in the closets. But then, our ambassadors and ministers in foreign courts are obliged to content themselves with what they consider very modest salaries, which do not at all allow of their competing in style and splendor with the ambassadors sent from the old despotic monarchies of Europe, under which the people who till the ground live in bare and wretched huts, and are supplied from year to year with only just enough food and clothing to keep them alive and enable them to continue their toil. But to return to Peter and his embassy. When the public reception was over, Peter introduced himself privately to the king in his own name, and the king, in a quiet and unofficial manner, paid him great attention. There were to be many more public ceremonies, banquets, and parades for the embassy in the city during their stay. But Peter withdrew himself entirely from the scene, and went out to a certain bay, which extended about 150 miles along the shore between Königsberg and Danzig, and occupied himself in examining the vessels which were there, and in sailing to and fro in them. This bay you will find delineated on any map of Europe. It extends along the coast for a considerable distance between Königsberg and Danzig, on the southeastern shore of the Baltic Sea. When the ambassadors and their train had finished their banquetings and celebrations in Königsberg, Peter joined them again, and the expedition proceeded to Danzig. This was at that time, as it is now, a large commercial city, being one of the chief ports on the Baltic for the exportation of grain from Poland and other fertile countries in the interior. By this time it began to be everywhere well known that Peter himself was traveling with the embassy. Peter would not, however, allow himself to be recognized at all, or permit any public notice to be taken of his presence, but went about freely in all the places that he visited with his own companions, just as if he were a private person, leaving all the public parades and receptions, and all the banquetings and other state and civic ceremonies, to the three ambassadors and their immediate train. A great many elegant and expensive presents, however, were sent in to him, under pretense of sending them to the ambassadors. The expedition travelled on in this way along the coasts of the Baltic Sea, on the way toward Holland, which was the country that Peter was most eager to see. At every city where they stopped, Peter went about examining the shipping. He was often attended by some important official of the place, but in other respects he went without any ceremony whatever. He used to change his dress, putting on, in the different places that he had visited, that which was worn by the common people of the town, so as not to attract any attention, and not even to be recognized as a foreigner. At one port, where there were a great many Dutch vessels that he wished to see, he wore the pea jacket, and the other sailor-like dress of a common Dutch skipper. in order that he might ramble about at his ease along the docks, and mingle freely with the seafaring men without attracting any notice at all. The people of Holland were aware that the embassy was coming into their country, and that Peter himself accompanied it, and they accordingly prepared to receive the party with the highest marks of honor. As the embassy, after crossing the frontier, moved on towards Amsterdam, salutes were fired from the ramparts of all the great towns that they passed. The soldiers were drawn out, and civic processions formed of magistrates and citizens met them at the gates to conduct them through the streets. The windows, too, and the roofs of all the houses were crowded with spectators. Wherever they stopped at night, bonfires and illuminations were made in honor of their arrival, and sometimes beautiful fireworks were played off in the evening before their palace windows. Of course, there was a great desire felt everywhere among the spectators to discover which of the personages who followed in the train of the embassy was the Tsar himself. They found it, however, impossible to determine this point, so completely had Peter disguised his person and merged himself with the rest. Indeed, in some cases, when the procession was moving forward with great ceremony, the object of the closest scrutiny in every part, for thousands of eyes, Peter himself was not in it at all. This was particularly the case on the occasion of the grand entry into Amsterdam. Peter left the party at a distance from the city, in order to go in quietly the next day, in company with some merchants with whom he had become acquainted. And accordingly, while all Amsterdam had gathered into the streets, and were watching with the most intense curiosity every train as it passed, in order to discover which one contained the great Tsar, the great Tsar himself was several miles away, sitting quietly with his friends, the merchants, at a table in a common country inn. The government and the people of Holland took a very great interest in this embassy, not only on account of the splendor of it, and the magnitude of the imperial power which it represented, but also on account of the business and pecuniary considerations which were involved. They wished very much to cultivate a good understanding with Russia, on account of the trade and commerce of that country, which was already very great, and was rapidly increasing. They determined, therefore, to show the embassy every mark of consideration and honor. Besides the measures which they adopted for giving the embassy itself a grand reception, the government set apart a spacious and splendid house in Amsterdam for the use of the Tsar during his stay. They did this in a somewhat private and informal manner, it is true, for they knew that Peter did not wish that his presence with the embassy should be openly noticed in any way. They organized also a complete household for this palace, including servants, attendants, and officers of all kinds, in a style corresponding to the dignity of the exalted personage who was expected to occupy it. But Peter, when he arrived, would not occupy the palace at all, but went into a quiet lodging among the shipping, where he could ramble about without constraint, and see all that was to be seen which could illustrate the art of navigation. The Dutch East India Company, which was then perhaps the greatest and most powerful association of merchants which had ever existed, had large shipyards where their vessels were built, at Saardam. Saardam was almost a suburb of Amsterdam, being situated on a deep river which empties into the Y, so called, which is the harbour of Amsterdam, and only a few miles from the town. Peter immediately made arrangements for going to these shipyards, and spending time while the embassy remained in that part of the country, in studying the construction of ships, and in becoming acquainted with the principal builders. Here, as the historians of the time say, he entered himself as a common ship-carpenter, being enrolled in the list of the company's workmen by the name Peter Michaelhoff, which was as nearly as possible his real name. He lived here several months, and devoted himself diligently to his work. He kept two or three of his companions with him, those whom he had brought from Moscow as his friends and associates on the tour, but they, it is said, did not take hold of the hard work with nearly as much zeal and energy as Peter displayed. Peter himself worked for the greatest part of every day among the other workmen, wearing also the same dress that they wore. When he was tired of work, he would go out on the water, and sail and row about in the different sorts of boats, so as to make himself practically acquainted with the comparative effects of the various modes of construction. The object which Peter had in view in all this was, doubtless, in a great measure his own enjoyment for the time being. He was so much interested in the subject of ships and shipbuilding, and in everything connected with navigation, that it was a delight to him to be in the midst of such scenes as were to be witnessed in the company's yards. He was still but a young man, and, like a great many other young men, he liked boats and the water. It is not probable, notwithstanding what is said by historians about his performances with the broadaxe, that he really did much serious work. Still, he was naturally fond of mechanical occupations, as the fact of his making a wheelbarrow with which to construct a fortification in his schoolboy days sufficiently indicates. Then again, his being in the shipyard so long, nominally as one of the workmen, gave him undoubtedly great facilities for observing everything which it was important that he should know. Of course, he could not have seriously intended to make himself an actual and practical ship carpenter, for, in the first place, the time was too short. A trade like that of a ship carpenter requires years of apprenticeship to make a really good workman. Then, in the second place, the mechanical part of the work was not the part which it devolved upon him, as a sovereign intent on building up a navy for the protection of his empire, even to superintend. He could not, therefore, have seriously intended to learn to build ships himself, but only to make himself nominally a workman, partly for the pleasure which it gave him to place himself so wholly at home among the shipping, and partly for the sake of the increased opportunities which he thereby obtained of learning many things which it was important that he should know. Travellers visiting Holland at the present day often go to Saardam to see the little building that is still shown as the shop which Peter occupied while he was there. It is a small wooden building, leaning and bent with age and decrepitude and darkened by exposure and time. Within the last half century, however, in order to save so curious a relic from further decay, the proprietors of the place have constructed around it and over it an outer building of brick, which encloses the hut itself like a case. The sides of the outer building are formed of large open arches, which allow the hut within to be seen. The ground on which the hut stands has also been laid out prettily as a garden, and is enclosed by a wall. Within this wall, and near the gate, is a very neat and pretty Dutch cottage, in which the custodian lives, who shows the place to strangers. While Peter was in the shipyards, the workmen knew who he was, but all persons were forbidden to gather around or gaze at him, or to interfere with him in any way by their notice or their attentions. They were to allow him to go and come as he pleased, without any molestation. These orders they observed as well as they could, as every one was desirous of treating their visitor in a manner as agreeable to him as possible, so as to prolong his stay. Peter varied his amusements while he thus resided in Saardam, by making occasional visits in a quiet and private way to certain friends in Amsterdam. He very seldom attended any of the great parades and celebrations which were continually taking place in honour of the embassy, but went only to the houses of men eminent in private life for their attainments in particular branches of knowledge, or for their experience or success as merchants or navigators. There was one person in particular that Peter became acquainted with in Amsterdam, whose company and conversation pleased him very much, and whom he frequently visited. This was a certain wealthy merchant, whose operations were on so vast a scale that he was accustomed to send off special expeditions at his own expense, all over the world, to explore new regions and discover new fields for his commercial enterprise. In order also to improve the accuracy of the methods employed by his shipmasters for ascertaining the latitude and longitude in navigating their ships, he built an observatory and furnished it with the telescopes, quadrants, and other costly instruments necessary for making the observations, all at his own expense. with this gentleman, and with the other persons in Amsterdam that Peter took a fancy to. He lived on very friendly and familiar terms. He often came in from Saardam to visit them, and would sometimes spend a considerable portion of the night in drinking and making merry with them. He assumed with these friends none of the reserve and dignity of demeanor that we should naturally associate with the idea of a king. Indeed, he was very blunt, and often rough and overbearing in his manners, not unfrequently doing and saying things which would scarcely be pardoned in a person of inferior station. When thwarted or opposed in any way, he was irritable and violent, and he evinced continually a temper that was very far from being amiable. In a word, though his society was eagerly sought by all whom he was willing to associate with, he seems to have made no real friends. Those who knew him admired his intelligence and his energy, and they respected his power, but he was not a man that anyone could love. Amsterdam, though it was the great commercial center of Holland, and indeed at that time of the world, was not the capital of the country. The seat of government was then, as now, at The Hague. Accordingly, after remaining as long at Amsterdam as Peter wished to amuse himself in the shipyards, the embassy moved on to The Hague, where it was received in a very formal and honorable manner by the king and the government. The presence of Peter could not be openly referred to, but very special and unusual honors were paid to the embassy in tacit recognition of it. At The Hague were resident ministers from all the great powers of Europe, and these all, with one exception, came to pay visits of ceremony to the ambassadors, which visits were, of course, duly returned with great pomp and parade. The exception was the minister of France. There was a coolness existing at this time between the Russian and the French governments, on account of something Peter had done in respect to the election of a king of Poland, which displeased the French king, and on this account the French minister declined taking part in the special honors paid to the embassy. The Hague was at this time, perhaps, the most influential and powerful capital of Europe. It was the center, in fact, of all important political movements and intrigues for the whole continent. The embassy accordingly paused here to take some rest from the fatigues and excitements of their long journey, and to allow Peter time to form and mature plans for further movements and operations. End of chapter 6.
Through the long night that is mankind's spiritual infancy, music is our fire, and literature is the wolf curled up beside her. This is 100.5 FM, Radio Lillooet, bringing you both since the turn of the millennium.
Chapter 7 of Peter the Great by Jacob Abbott. Conclusion of the tour, 1697. While the embassy itself was occupied with the parades and ceremonies at The Hague and at Utrecht, where they had a grand interview with the States General, and at other great political centres, Peter travelled to and fro about Holland, visiting the different ports, and examining the shipping that he found in them, with the view of comparing the different models, for there were vessels in these ports from almost all the maritime countries of Europe. His attention was at last turned to some English ships, which pleased him very much. He liked the form of them better than that of the Dutch ships that he had seen. He soon made the acquaintance of a number of English shipmasters and ship carpenters, and obtained from them, through an interpreter of course, a great deal of information in respect to the state of the art of shipbuilding in their country. He heard that in England naval carpentry had been reduced to a regular science, and that the forms and models of the vessels built there were determined by fixed mathematical principles which every skilful and intelligent workman was expected to understand and to practice upon, whereas in Holland the carpenters worked by rote, each new set following their predecessors by a sort of mechanical imitation, without being governed by any principles or theory at all. Peter immediately determined that he would go to England and study the English methods himself on the spot, as he had already studied those of Holland. The political relations between England and Holland were at this time of a very intimate character, the King of England being William, Prince of Orange. The King, when he heard of Peter's intention, was much pleased, and determined to do all in his power to promote his views in making the journey. He immediately provided the Tsar with a number of English attendants to accompany him on his voyage, and to remain with him in England during his stay. Among these were interpreters, secretaries, valets, and a number of cooks and other domestic servants. These persons were paid by the King of England himself, and were ordered to accompany Peter to England, to remain with him all the time that he was there, and then to return with him to Holland, so that during the whole period of his absence he should have no trouble whatever in respect to his personal comforts or wants. These preparations having been all made, the Tsar left the embassy, and taking with him the company of servants which the King had provided, and also the few private friends who had been with him all the time since leaving Moscow, he sailed from a certain port in the southwestern part of Holland, called Helvoet Sluis, about the middle of the month of January. He arrived without any incident at London. Here he at first took up his abode in a handsome house which the King had ordered to be provided and furnished for him. This house was in a genteel part of town, where the noblemen and other persons belonging to the court resided. It was very pleasantly situated near the river, and the grounds pertaining to it extended down to the water side. Still, it was far away from the part of the city which was devoted to commerce and the shipping, and Peter was not very well satisfied with it on that account. He, however, went to it at first, and continued to occupy it for some time. In this house the Tsar was visited by a great number of the nobility, and he visited them in return. He also received particular attentions from such members of the royal family as were then in London. But the person whose society pleased him most was one of the nobility, who, like himself, took a great interest in maritime affairs. This was the Duke of Leeds. The Duke kept a number of boats at the foot of his gardens in London, and he and Peter used often to go out together in the river, and row and sail in them. Among other attentions which were paid to Peter by the government during his stay in London, one was the appointment of a person to attend upon him for the purpose of giving him, at any time, such explanations or such information as he might desire in respect to the various institutions of England, whether those relating to government, to education, or to religion. The person thus appointed was Bishop Burnet, a very distinguished dignitary of the Church. The bishop could, of course, only converse with Peter through interpreters, but the practice of conversing in that way was very common in those days, and persons were specially trained and educated to translate the language of one person to another in an easy and agreeable manner. In this way Bishop Burnet held from time to time various interviews with the Tsar, but it seems that he did not form a very favourable opinion of his temper and character. The bishop, in an account of these interviews which he subsequently wrote, said that Peter was a man of strong capacity and of much better general education than might have been expected from the manner of life which he had led, but that he was of a very hot and violent temper, and that he was very brutal in his language and demeanour when he was in a passion. The bishop expressed himself quite strongly on this point, saying that he could not but adore the depth of the providence of God that had raised such a furious man to so absolute an authority over so great a part of the world. It was seen in the end how wise was the arrangement of Providence in the selection of this instrument for the accomplishment of its designs, for the reforms which, notwithstanding the violence of his personal character and the unjust and cruel deeds which he sometimes performed, Peter was the means of introducing, and those to which the changes he made afterward led, have advanced and are still advancing more and more every year the whole moral, political, and social condition of all the populations of Northern Europe and Asia, and have instituted a course of progress and improvement which will, perhaps, go on without being again arrested to the end of time. The bishop says that he found Peter somewhat curious to learn what the political and religious institutions of England were, but that he did not manifest any intention or desire to introduce them into his own country. The chief topic which interested him, even in talking with the bishop, was that of his purposes and plans in respect to ships and shipping. He gave the bishop an account of what he had done and of what he intended to do for the elevation and improvement of his people. But all his plans of this kind were confined to such improvements as would tend to the extension and aggrandisement of his own power. In other words, the ultimate object of the reforms which he was desirous of introducing was not the comfort and happiness of the people themselves, but his own exaltation and glory among the potentates of the earth as their hereditary and despotic sovereign. After remaining some time in the residence which the king had provided for him at the court end of the town, Peter contrived to have a house set apart for him below bridge, as the phrase was, that is, among the shipping. There was but one bridge across the Thames in those days, and the position of that one, of course, determined the limit of that part of the river and town that could be devoted to the purposes of commerce and navigation, for ships, of course, could not go above it. The house which was now provided for Peter was near the royal shipyard. There was a back gate which opened from the yard of the house into the shipyard, so that Peter could go and come when he pleased. Peter remained in this new lodging for some time. He often went into the shipyard to watch the men at their operations, and while there would often take up the tools and work with them. At other times he would ramble about the streets of London in company with his two or three particular friends, examining everything which was new or strange to him, and talking with his companions in respect to the expediency or feasibility of introducing the article or the usage, whatever it might be, as an improvement into his own dominions. In these excursions, Peter was sometimes dressed in the English citizen's dress, and sometimes he wore the dress of a common sailor. In the latter costume he found that he could walk about more freely on the wharves and along the docks without attracting observation. But notwithstanding all that he could do to disguise himself, he was often discovered. Some person, perhaps, who had seen him and his friends in the shipyard would recognize him and point him out. Then it would be whispered from one to another among the bystanders that that was the Russian emperor, and people would follow him where he went, or gather around him where he was standing. In such cases as this, as soon as Peter found that he was recognized, and was beginning to attract attention, he always went immediately away. Among other objects of interest, which attracted Peter's attention in London, was the Tower, where there was kept then, as now, an immense collection of arms of all kinds. This collection consists not only of a vast store of the weapons in use at the present day, laid up there to be ready for service whenever they may be required, but also a great number and variety of specimens of those which were employed in former ages, but are now superseded by new inventions. Peter, as might naturally have been expected, took a great deal of interest in examining these collections. In respect to all the more ordinary objects of interest for strangers in London, the shops, the theatres, the parks, the gay parties given by the nobility at the West End, and other such spectacles, Peter saw them all, but he paid very little attention to them. His thoughts were almost entirely engrossed by subjects connected with his navy. He found, as he had expected from what he heard in Holland, that the English ship carpenters had reduced their business quite to a system, being accustomed to determine the proportions of the model by fixed principles, and to work in the construction of the ship from drafts made by rule. When he was in the shipyard, he studied this subject very attentively, and although it was, of course, impossible that in so short a time he should make himself fully master of it, he was still able to obtain such a general insight into the nature of the method as would very much assist him in making arrangements for introducing it into his own country. There was another measure which he took that was even more important still. He availed himself of every opportunity which was afforded him, while engaged in the shipyards and docks, to become acquainted with the workmen, especially the head workmen of the yards, and he engaged a number of them to go to Russia and enter into his service there in the work of building his navy. In a word, the Tsar was much better pleased with the manner in which the work of shipbuilding was carried on in England than with anything that he had seen in Holland, so much so that he said he wished that he had come directly to England at first, inasmuch as now, since he had seen how much superior were the English methods, he considered the long stay which he had made in Holland as pretty nearly lost time. After remaining as long and learning as much in the dockyards in and below London as he thought the time at his command would allow, Peter went to Portsmouth to visit the Royal Navy at anchor there. The arrangement which nature has made of the southern coast of England seems almost as if expressly intended for the accommodation of a great national and mercantile marine. In the first place, at the town of Portsmouth, there is a deep and spacious harbour entirely surrounded and protected by land. Then, at a few miles distant, off the coast, lies the Isle of Wight, which brings under shelter a sheet of water not less than 5 miles wide and 20 miles long, where all the fleets and navies of the world might lie at anchor in safety. There is an open access to this sound both from the east and from the west, and yet the shores curve in such a manner that both entrances are well protected from the ingress of storms. Directly opposite to Portsmouth, and within this enclosed sea, is a place where the water is just of the right depth, and the bottom of just the right conformation for the convenient anchoring of ships of war. This place is called Spithead, and it forms one of the most famous anchoring grounds in the world. It is here that the vast fleets of the English Navy assemble, and here the ships come to anchor when returning home from their distant voyages. The view of these grim-looking sea monsters, with their double and triple rows of guns, lying quietly at their moorings, as seen by the spectator from the deck of the steamer which glides through and among them, on the way from Portsmouth to the Isle of Wight, is extremely imposing. Indeed, when considered by a mind capable of understanding, in some degree, the vast magnitude and extension of the power which lies thus reposing there, the spectacle becomes truly sublime. In order to give Peter a favourable opportunity to see the fleet at Spithead, the King of England commissioned the Admiral in command of the Navy to accompany him to Portsmouth and to put the fleet to sea, with a view of exhibiting a mock naval engagement in the Channel. Nothing could exceed the pleasure which this spectacle afforded to the Tsar. He expressed his admiration of it in the most glowing terms, and said that he verily believed that an admiral of the English fleet was a happier man than the Tsar of Muscovy. At length, when the time arrived for Peter to set out on his return to his own dominions, the King of England made him a present of a beautiful yacht, which had been built for his own use in his voyages between England and Holland. The name of the yacht was the Royal Transport. It was an armed vessel carrying 24 guns, and was well built and richly finished and furnished in every respect. The Tsar set sail from England in this yacht, taking with him the companions that he had brought with him into England, and also a considerable number of the persons whom he had engaged to enter into his service in Russia. Some of these persons were to be employed in the building of ships, and others in the construction of a canal to connect the River Don with the River Volga. The Don flows into the Black, and the Volga into the Caspian Sea, and the object of the canal was to allow Peter's vessels to pass from one sea into the other at pleasure. As soon as the canal should be opened, ships could be built on either river for use in either sea. The persons who had been engaged for these various purposes were promised, of course, very large rewards to induce them to leave their country. Many of them afterward had occasion bitterly to regret their having entered the service of such a master. They complained that, after their arrival in Russia, Peter treated them in a very unjust and arbitrary manner. They were held as prisoners more than as salaried workmen, being very closely watched and guarded to prevent their making their escape and going back to their own country before finishing what Peter wished them to do. Then a large portion of their pay was kept back, on the plea that it was necessary for the emperor to have security in his own hands for their fidelity in the performance of their work, and for their remaining at their posts until their work was done. There was one gentleman in particular, a Scotch mathematician and engineer, who had been educated at the University of Aberdeen, that complained of the treatment which he received in a full and formal protest, which he addressed to Peter in writing, and which is still on record. He makes out a very strong case in respect of the injustice with which he was treated. But however disappointed these gentlemen may have been in the end, they left England in the Emperor's beautiful yacht, much elated with the honour they had received in being selected by such a potentate for the execution of important trusts in a distant land, and with high anticipations of the fame and fortune which they expected to acquire before the time should arrive for them to return to their own country. From England the yacht sailed to Holland, where Peter disembarked, in order to join the embassy and accompany them in their visits to some other courts in Central Europe before returning home. He first went to Vienna. He still nominally preserved his incognito, but the Emperor Leopold, who was at that time the Emperor of Germany, gave him a very peculiar sort of reception. He came out to the door of his antechamber to meet Peter at the head of a certain back staircase communicating with the apartment, which was intended for his own private use. Peter was accompanied by General Lefort, the chief ambassador at this interview, and he was conducted up the staircase by two grand officers of the Austrian court, the Grand Chamberlain and the Grand Equerry. After the two potentates had been introduced to each other, the emperor, who had taken off his hat to bow to the Tsar, put it on again, but Peter remained uncovered, on the ground that he was not at that time acting in his own character as Tsar. The emperor, seeing this, took off his hat again, and both remained uncovered during the interview. After this, a great many parades and celebrations took place in Vienna, all ostensibly in honour of the embassy, but really and truly in honour of Peter himself, who still preserved his incognito. At many of these festivities Peter attended, taking his place with the rest of the subordinates in the train of the embassy, but he never appeared in his own true character. Still he was known, and he was the object of a great many indirect but very marked attentions. On one occasion, for example, there was a masked ball in the palace of the emperor. Peter appeared there dressed as a peasant of West Friesland, which is a part of North Holland, where the costumes worn by the common people were then, as indeed they are at the present day, very marked and peculiar. The Emperor of Germany appeared also at this ball in a feigned character, that of a host at an entertainment, and he had 32 pages in attendance upon him, all dressed as butlers. In the course of the evening, one of the pages brought out to the emperor a very curious and costly glass, which he filled with wine and presented to the emperor, who then approached Peter and drank to the health of the peasant of West Friesland, saying at the same time, with a meaning look, that he was well aware of the inviolable affection which the peasant felt for the Tsar of Muscovy. Peter, in return, drank to the health of the host, saying he was aware of the inviolable affection he felt for the Emperor of Germany. These toasts were received by the whole company with great applause, and after they were drunk, the Emperor gave Peter the curious glass from which he had drunk, desiring him to keep it as a souvenir of the occasion. These festivities in honour of the embassy at Vienna were at length suddenly interrupted by the arrival of tidings from Moscow that a rebellion had broken out there against Peter's government. This intelligence changed at once all Peter's plans. He had intended to go to Venice and to Rome, but he now at once abandoned these designs, and setting out abruptly from Vienna with General Lefort and a train of about 30 persons, he travelled with the utmost possible dispatch to Moscow. End of chapter 7.
Ladies and gentlemen, Join us next week for another episode of Radio Lillooet's special presentation of Jacob Abbott's Peter the Great in 7 parts.